We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour, my guest is Gay Talese. He is one of this country's best-known writers of nonfiction. He's one of a handful of writers who created a new style of journalism in the 1960s by applying techniques borrowed from fiction to the telling of stories about real people. He worked for a number of years for The New York Times. He's also written for other publications, including Esquire, Harper's, The New Yorker, and Newsweek. He's the author of 11 books on a range of subjects, including the history of The New York Times, America's sexual revolution. He's also written a memoir about his family's history. And most recent to appear is a collection of his sports writing. The title of that book is The Silent Season of a Hero, and it takes its title from one of the pieces in this collection, a very well-known piece that he wrote for Esquire back in the mid-1960s about Joe DiMaggio. So that book is out now. It's published by Walker, if you'd like to read it. He is this year's recipient of the Illinois Prize for Lifetime Achievement in Journalism. It's something that's selected annually by the U of I journalism faculty to honor someone important in their field. He's the fourth person to receive the award. He's joining us this morning by telephone. We'll talk about his writing. The questions, of course, are welcome. If you would like to call in and talk with Gay Talese, you can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Also email will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions, comments are welcome. We do ask people to try and be brief just so that we can keep moving along. But, of course, anyone who's listening can join in the conversation. Gay Talese, hello.
Good afternoon, Mr. Inge. Nice to speak.
Well, Mr. Talese, we certainly appreciate it. It's a great pleasure and privilege. You have talked a lot about the thing that attracted you to writing was the opportunity to write stories about real stories about real people. Is it the case, though, that you were never really had an impulse, never really thought about writing fiction?
I once did write a short story that was published, and it was when I was about 29 or 30. I was still on the New York Times then, and but I always read short stories. Fiction has been my guiding light, to tell you the truth. I grew up reading the works of F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway and Thomas Wolfe. Of course, these were the big names when I was a kid in the 1940s. And still later, into the more modern writers, many of them were working at the New Yorker, such as John O'Hara and Irwin Shaw. And Carson McCullers had a story in the New Yorker that caught my attention, and I was influenced by it. And I'll mention these things in a moment. But The point is that the storytelling technique of fiction writers was what drew me to made me interested in writing. But what made me depart from the fiction writers that I've mentioned and others that I came to know through their work, what separated me was a desire to bring reality into fiction writing and call it not fiction, but a kind of literary nonfiction that adhered to the tradition of journalism, which is factual verifiability. To be honest, to be truthful, to get the names right, to not change the names, not change the situation, but rather to know through research, to do so much research that you really had a depth of knowledge about the people you're writing about or the situation you're describing, that you could write in a way that the reader would think you made it up, but you didn't make it up, that you could prove you didn't make it up. And that was, I thought, for me, a challenge beyond writing fiction, because I wanted to do something different. When I grew up, the fiction writers were the writers. And the journalists or the magazine writers or the people who wrote biographies or people who wrote current events in book form were more gatherers of facts, but they weren't exhibitors of style. they weren't storytellers. And what I wanted to do was to be a storyteller, but to break the path and to depart company with the fiction writers who were using their imaginations to tell this story, who were embellishing the facts, who were exaggerating, who were lying in a way, because fiction is all about lying. Whereas nonfiction, journalism included, is to be reliably accurate, verifiably accurate, so people could check you out and say, oh, he didn't tell the full truth here. And I wanted to meet those standards of reliability, and yet I wanted to write stories. So it sounds confusing, and maybe there's a sense of conflict about this, but this is what motivated me.
Well, I wonder if in part it also was the feeling that there were so many good stories out there, real stories, that you felt, well, why make up characters?
Well,
these real people are really as good as anybody I could make up.
Mr. Inge, you're absolutely right. There are stories around you. No matter who in your audience is listening now, it could be said of them that they know people and they themselves have privy to stories that sound as if they are fantastic, that they're part of fantasy, that they're part of creativity of the mind, and yet they're based in fact. And I knew this when I was a kid, 11, 12 years old. My mother had a dress shop in my hometown, which is in southern New Jersey, and those women were regular customers. They were women of the afternoon. They would go into my mother's dress shop. They had a lot of time on their hands, and they had deep pockets. They were rather affluent members of the community, these middle-aged women, and they go in looking for dresses and sometimes took a long time to find what they wanted. But in the process of browsing through the racks of clothing, they would be chatting and they'd be telling stories. They'd be telling stories about themselves, things they saw the day before, experiences they had the night as they came into the store, things they observed as they passed through the town. And they'd tell these things, and they were not necessarily shocking revelations of any kind. They were just ordinary stories, but I thought they were interesting. And I got to know a lot about these ordinary people, these women who shopped in the dress shop my mother happened to own. And I thought, gee, I'd like to write about that sort of stuff someday. And this is the material that fiction writers use. A Tennessee Williams play is about maybe women with a sense of fantasy about themselves. Or an Arthur Miller play, Death of a Salesman. Willie Loman is an ordinary guy. He's not a super salesman. He's not Donald Trump. He is a kind of mediocre man, Willie Loman. And yet Willie Loman as a character, out of the imagination of the playwright Arthur Miller, is an international figure. Willie Loman, the play, Arthur Miller's play, Death of a Salesman, you can find that in Chinese on the stages of Beijing. It's played on stages in all over Europe and South America and Latin and Africa. I mean, that character crosses all sorts of language barriers and geographical areas. It's all over. And what is it about? It's about a salesman who doesn't sell very much and doesn't sell very well and doesn't sell himself very well either. It's a tragic character, but so is much of Shakespeare's tragic character. You see that. So, but we're getting off the subject, I'm afraid, because the question you asked, why didn't I make it up? But I'm answering to that query was, you don't have to make it up.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You follow me?
Sure. Over the last 50 years or so, you talk to a lot of people, some of them celebrities maybe, but probably most not. And when you first sit down to talk with someone, they don't know you, you really don't know them. What do you do to get somebody like that to open up and start talking about their life?
Well, you first of all have to establish a confidence and trust. And that comes very much within yourself, how you approach people. Well, I mentioned my growing up in a store, my mother's dress shop. People who are successful in business, who own a store. Let's, for example, be specific about my own mother having, who falls into this category of being a store owner. The way you deal with the public, the way you deal with customers, is the first should be the way you deal with, as a journalist, with people, which is to say, with politeness, always being well-mannered, and not being aggressive. You, as a journalist, you are selling something. You're selling yourself. Just as my mother was selling dresses, so was it as me, her son, as a journalist, selling myself. And what I'm selling is trust. As my mother was a trustworthy person who didn't guide her customers incorrectly when she chose things that she thought they would look their best in. And if it didn't work out, they could trust that she would refund the money. And there's the trust on many levels. Well, journalists have to be trustworthy. They can't just take advantage of people, get the people to lower their guard, and then write things that are going to be very, very harmful to the character of the persons they're writing about. So there has to be something like that. There has to be something of a sincerity about the inquiring journalist, and that is to be sincerely interested in the people you're writing about, and your curiosity is not in the area of gossip or spreading false rumor, but rather just genuine interest in the character you're writing about based on the fact that you think those people have something to say about their time, if not verbally, at least the way they live. They represent something of that period in which the person is a part. And what you have to do is be patient. The areas where I think I'm successful is I have inordinate amounts of curiosity about other people. I'm not narcissistic. I'm not so self-centered that I think the world revolves around me, because it's the other way. I always think of myself being in the world of other people, because I wonder about other people. And I wonder, how are they different from me, maybe? But I also wonder how they themselves get through the day and night and the weeks, and how do they do it? How do they go about whatever it is they do, whether they're performing athletes, performing actors, politicians, business people, people who are trying to sell something in the big market or the small markets, whoever they are, I want to know, how do they do what they do, and how do they feel about what they do, and what is there about them that makes them connected in a relevant way to the larger world? So they're characters, and I get to know them, and I get to know them over a period of time, which allows me to feel that I become intimately engaged, not only in what they do, but how they think. And that, so what it is you have to, it's almost like a romance. I don't want to sound as if I'm writing for the flattery of the people I'm writing about, because I never am. I never show them what I write until it's published. But what I'm really trying to say in the beginning, I am, it's like a courtship. It's like you're on a date. You're on a date. You're a college kid. You're knocking on the door, some sorority house, and you're going to meet someone some young lady for the first time. And you're getting to know someone. And that's what it's like in the kind of work I do. You just knock on the door, and you spend some time with the first person. You barely know them. And then you see them again, and now you're knowing them a little better than you did the first time. And then a second time, and a third time, and a fourth time, and a fifth time. And you see people. And you see them not only as you saw them the first time, but you recognize that your first impressions might not have been lasting ones. They reveal themselves in a different way, and you realize there's some complexity about the character of these people. And what I do is I don't ever sit down with a pencil and pad and take notes. I don't do that. I just want to spend some time with people doing what they're doing. They might be shopping, so I'll go shopping with them. They might be picking up their car. It's been repaired, so I'll go to the repair shop with them, and I'll watch how they're talking to the mechanic. And I might have a little scene of the disappointment on the part of the car owner that the carburetor wasn't fixed, or that the car wasn't functioning even after being repaired. Whatever it is, it's a scene in the garage. That could be a little scene in the movie. That could be a scene in a short story. It could be a scene in a play, or a scene in a garage can be dramatized. It can be written in such a way that the audience, the reader, the theater goer, has a real sense of participation in the event. And so it's really an art form. Journalism can be a form of art. Artful journalism is possible if it's storytelling. So the key is curiosity, followed by patience with the people you're trying to indulge your curiosity about. And then when it comes to writing what you think you know from the research you've done, writing as well as any fiction writer, writing in a way that has a scene in the beginning and the reader can identify, can visualize the scene because you're writing visually. And this kind of writing isn't done on a first draft basis. You have to redo it and redo it. And in your head, you must have a sense of what is possible in the writing of prose. And you get the sense of possibility by reading great writers, by reading Tolstoy, reading Ernest Hemingway, or reading it could be Joyce Carol Oates, it could be any of your favorite writers. It doesn't have to be any genre writer. It could be mystery writers. It could be science fiction writers. Whatever, it doesn't make any difference. You have a certain standard that some of your favorite writers have met, and you aspire to meet these standards. And I did that all my life. I mean, I did that when I was 15, 16, 17, and I'm 77, and I still do it. So it isn't something you outgrow. You have certain standards that have been set by the people you most admire. And you always, when you're writing your own stuff, you try to meet your own highest standards. And then the writing has to be redone and redone and redone to have a certain level met. And it looks easy maybe with the reader. Reads and reads and thinks, oh, this looks easy. It moves so gracefully from page to page, paragraph to paragraph. But it's anything but easy. You know, the great performers, sometimes you see a great dancer, Gene Kelly dancing, singing in the rain. Oh, it looks so easy. Anybody can do it. Umbrella, you're up and down the curb, and the rain is falling on your head as you're singing. Well, that was probably done before as the cameras were capturing that scene, probably done 100 times. I actually know a guy that was part of that production company that produced that Gene Kelly movie in which that great scene is remembered of singing in the rain. He said Kelly did it 100 times, back and forth. And that when it's finally filmed and it looks on the screen, it looks the easy, anybody could do it. Well, it's not true. Nobody could do it unless you go through what Gene Kelly, went through, which was perfecting each step after step.
Let me reintroduce for anybody who might have just tuned in. We're talking this morning with Gay Talese. He's the author of a number of books on a very wide range of topics. He's written a lot of magazine articles, worked for a number of years for the New York Times. Most recent out is a collection of his sports writing. The title of that is The Silent Season of a Hero. Just recently received an award from the University of Illinois, this year's recipient of the Illinois Prize for Lifetime Achievement in Journalism. Well, the award was presented a week ago today in New York. He's the fourth person to receive the award. The others include Mike Wallace, Ben Bradley, and Seymour Hersh. And we're talking about his writing and his approach to journalism, and questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think sometimes that we have this idea that journalists are supposed to be kind of like anthropologists, in the sense that they go to observe another culture and they're not supposed to get involved. They're supposed to maintain this professional distance, just take notes. And you were among a group of journalists who took a really different approach, really plunging in some personal and sometimes controversial ways to the topic that you were writing about. What was it, you think, that motivated you to be, as a journalist, maybe a little bit more than a bystander?
Well, the life that I lived, which was not an exceptionally active one, rather passive one. I did mention the fact of my mother having a store, and that was influential in my life. I must tell you more, because I have to say, at the age of 10 or 11, I would see the customers coming into the store, and they had stories to tell about themselves in the course of conversation. But also working in the back of the store were workers who altered dresses and pressed dresses, and there were some employees, and they also had stories to tell. The store was on the main street of a small town. It was Main Street. And the apartment that my mother and father had was above the store. So when the store was closed, 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the evening, my parents would go upstairs, and they would relax, and sometimes they'd have dinner up there, sometimes we'd go out to a restaurant, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. And I noticed how different my parents were at night than they were during the day. During the day, they were engaged in conversation with and participating as workers in the store. At night, they would talk about other things, and their character was quite different. And I was seeing the difference between day and night as it was reflected in the personalities of my parents. And this store, this building with the apartment upstairs and the store downstairs, was like a little theater in my head. It was like a theater, and where it was like a two levels of life in an ordinary family in an ordinary town between night and day. This encompassed this theater, this store, this place in my head was a place where characters, personalities changed from day to day and from day to night. And I just thought, journalism doesn't have to be all about bombings and murders and fires sweeping through neighborhoods and trauma and tragedy. Journalism can reflect ordinary life under the most ordinary circumstances if it's written well, if there's a certain sense of defining the character of the personalities you're writing about. So this first store was really my school of journalism. I mean, I had a sense of what could be done in storytelling long before I went to college and studied journalism. In fact, when I studied journalism, first I went to the University of Alabama, and I wasn't even very good in journalism at the University of Alabama. And the reason I wasn't very good is because the journalism that was presented as proper there was very formulaic. The journalism was who, what, when, where, in a very organized way, with no sense of character. I wanted to start every story with a scene so that the reader could get a picture of the person, either the description of the person that's supposed to be written about or something that is a scene in which the person is involved in some way. I wanted to have a story. Everything was to be a story. And the facts were, I didn't want the facts to go, to just be all facts and nothing about the personality of the person I was writing about. And so I think my background prepared me for what I did for the rest of my life. And my background was one of ordinary life. And as a writer all the way through my life, I've tended to write as much, if not more, about ordinary people than anybody that had anything special about them. Of course, and even when I wrote about people who are very special, let's say celebrities, such as, for example, I once wrote a famous article, famous because it's in anthologies of college students, often is that Frank Sinatra has a cold.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I wrote Frank Sinatra, it isn't really Sinatra that I spoke to because he really was reluctant to talk to me. He had a cold, and he also had some other reasons for being reluctant to submit to an interview. And I just talked to the ordinary people around Sinatra, and there are very many ordinary people. For example, some of the people who sat in the back of an orchestra, maybe the third trumpet player, or somebody who was maybe the sound technician that worked behind in the studio where Sinatra would be recording, making records or presenting a live concert. And I talked to them, these ordinary people, people such as I came to know when I was working in the store, my mother's store. You could talk about Sinatra or have Sinatra reflected in the perceptions of those who were in the orchestra behind him, or maybe the lighting technicians, as I said, or the man who was his automobile driver, his chauffeur, or maybe someone who was in charge of of dressing him, you know, the costume department, or the he had a woman that used to collect his hair pieces. He used to wear toupees, and I talked to her a lot. And so all of them had a particular point of view and maybe even an attitude about Frank Sinatra. And this 30, 40, 50 people I talked to had something to do, maybe at a distance, but still something to do with Frank Sinatra. And it was from those people that I drew my character, that I painted my picture, that I elicited the information about Frank Sinatra, not from him. And there's where my use of and my comfort with ordinary people served me well. And that's been true of all that I've written.
Yeah. And it's a great piece, and if people would like to read it, it was published in Esquire, and people can go to the Esquire magazine website, and they can read the piece. It was published in 1966.
I think that's true.
It's there. And also another piece of that era that's well known and people might want to look at is the DiMaggio piece that's in The Silent Season of a Hero. In fact, that's what it's called, Silent Season of a Hero, and it's in that book. That was also done for Esquire about the same time, I think. We have a caller. Someone would like to join into the conversation.
You.
We'll do that. And, of course, we'll continue to talk here this morning with Gay Talese. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. There's someone here in Champaign County where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Yes.
Or afternoon. I confess that I escaped your body of work. I think I read a couple of articles here and there, but I know you're touted for. But about Sinatra, I also escaped knowing that he was hated as being a evading service in World War II. I don't know how I managed to escape that facet of his career, but. So confessing ignorance, I wanted to ask you about how you dealt with covering the complexities of writing about the mafia, because. I mean, there were a lot of different gangs in New York. The political elite was not above being thuggish and gang-like in their own right, and there was a lot of Robin Hood sentiment from a variety of people, I suppose, sort of misguided or not. So I just wanted to know how you might have dealt with that.
Well, you want me to tell you how I got into the mafia?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Sinatra, right?
Go ahead.
Well, we're talking about the mafia family. We're talking about the book I wrote called Honor Thy Father. Isn't that what you're referring to?
I'm sure it is, yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, I told you, or I mentioned before, that when I was a journalist working for a paper full-time, it was the New York Times. And in 1965, I think I was 31 or 32 years old. And 1965, I was sent by the editor, the city editor of the paper, of the New York Times, to cover the indictment of a man in the mafia whose name is Bill Bonanno. His father, Joe Bonanno, was the godfather of that organization called the Bonanno family, the Bonanno Mafia family. And the guy that was just indicted was the 32-year-old son of Joe Bonanno, and this guy's named Bill Bonanno. And I was just sent to write a little story about this. And I went to the federal courthouse in Lower Manhattan, myself and a dozen other reporters and television people and radio people. And I remember during a recess, Bill Bonanno had gone before a judge, and then there was a break in the proceedings, and Bill Bonanno and his attorneys came out to the corridor in the federal courthouse. And we journalists were on the other side of the corridor, and I was talking to them. And then I saw Bill Bonanno and talking to his attorneys on the other side, and I thought, I just left my group of fellow reporters, and I walked across the corridor. And I approached one of the attorneys that was closest to me, who was standing in front of Bill Bonanno, and I said, "Excuse me, I wanted to say something, but I don't want you to comment on it because I know you won't. But I wanted to say to you that I'm the same age, approximately, as your client, Bill Bonanno. And I wonder if I could sometime write about him as to how he got to be where he is today, which is to be indicted. Because if he should die, either by gun warfare, which is so much a part of life, or live to a long age and die of natural causes. His obituary, this fellow, Bill Bonanno, this guy, this obituary, of which is the summation of his life, all the information about his life that will go into the public record, that will go into the newspapers when he dies, will have been gotten from law enforcement authorities, will have been gotten from the Justice Department in Washington, or the FBI. And all it will be would be a reflection of the government's attitude toward Bill Bonanno. And yet Bill Bonanno has another attitude that will never, never, never see the light of day, that will never be published, that his children will never read about, or his grandchildren will never know about. And the reason they won't is because nobody knows Bill Bonanno. And I hope someday, I said to the lawyer, they were looking at me spellbound. They just couldn't understand what I'm talking about. And no one was saying anything. I was just babbling on. But I was saying someday, not now, not this year, maybe not next year either, but someday I'd like to write about, from his point of view, what it's like to be him. Excuse me for interrupting you, gentlemen. I hope I didn't take too much of your time. They both said nothing. And Bill, I saw Bill Bonanno turn to me, and he looked at me, and he caught my attention with his eyes. He looked at me. A sense of wonderment is what I perceived coming out of him, and maybe also some curiosity, because maybe something I said about after he dies, no one will know about him because all the information will come from the cops and the Justice Department and then the eavesdroppers and everybody, and not from him. And I thought I caught his attention somehow. After that, I walked away, and a couple of days later, I knew the name of the lawyer whose office was near the federal courthouse in Lower Manhattan. And I wrote a letter to the lawyer. I said, I'm the guy that talked to you a couple days ago, and I'm going to keep in touch with you. And I kept in touch with that lawyer. Every few weeks, I'd write again. And I said, I'd like to someday, you remind your client, we want to talk sometime. You know, 2 years passed. 2 full years passed. That was in 65 when I met him. Around 1967, I called the lawyer and said, hey, you know, it's funny you should call. Bill Bonanno was saying, he's out of jail now, but maybe you want to have dinner. He doesn't want you to write about him. He doesn't want anything in the New York Times or any magazine or anywhere. But sometimes he'd like to just talk to you. It's fine. We'll just have dinner. No conversation. We'll go into print. Just private conversation. So this was a dinner I had in 1967 with a lawyer, Bill Bonanno, at some restaurant on the east side of Manhattan, probably mafia-connected restaurant. And that's how I began, and I had another dinner with him, and then another dinner with him. And we had occasionally had dinners once a month or whenever. And then I got to the point in 1969, 4 years after I first met him in the courthouse, he was about to go to jail in California in Terminal Island near San Diego, near San Jose, near a little south of, near Long Beach, I think it is. And he said, I'm going to go away for 4 years because of credit card violation. He signed somebody's name to a credit card and he got caught. There was a card, some fellow mafia guy gave him a card, and Bill Bonanno made charges on that card, got caught, and was going to be put away for 4 years for this federal offense. And he said, if we're going to talk, now's the time, because I'm going to go away for 4 years. I have a few months before I go into jail. So he says, come on in, I'll tell you my story. And I went out there to California. He lived at that time in San Jose, in Northern California. He was going to be sent to this federal prison in Southern California, not far from Los Angeles. And so I spent 3 or 4 months actually out there in San Jose, California, talking to him every day and got his whole story. And then I wrote that book called Honor Thy Father based on that. But here's a case of knowing a guy, for a four-year period and writing nothing until the end when I finally did have his permission. A lot of it's about timing, you know. Mm. So does that answer your question?
I hope that it does. Let me just, for anyone again who just tuned in, we have about 15 minutes left. Our guest is Gay Talese. He's the author of a number of books, including the one he was just talking about, Honor Thy Father. He's also written The Kingdom and the Power. That's a book about the New York Times. He wrote a book about the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s. He's written a memoir about his own family history. Most recently, there has been a collection of his sports writing published. That book is The Silent Season of a Hero. He's written for many publications, Esquire, Harper's, New Yorker, Newsweek, and he also worked for a number of years for the New York Times. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You grew up in New Jersey and then you went to school in Alabama. Was that something of a culture shock for you?
Well, it wasn't. It might have been culture shock for people in Alabama when I went there. I don't know. But what happened was this: that I wasn't. I've already described myself as a person of some curiosity, more than an ordinary amount of curiosity. But as a student in school, grade school and later high school in Ocean City, New Jersey, I was not outstanding. I was, in fact, near the bottom of the class. What I was good at, mentioned curiosity and patience, there were not grades for that. There was no classes for that. What I wasn't good at was chemistry and mathematics and geography and history and even English. I wasn't good at anything. At least the grades did not reflect well. So when I got to be 17, about to graduate from high school, my father would like to have had me go to a college, but no college would like to have me. I was turned down by Rutgers, which is in New Jersey, and all the colleges that were within 100 miles of my home, meaning colleges in Pennsylvania and neighboring New York. I couldn't get in. But there was one man who was a customer in the store. My mother was the breadwinner in that family because of her selling dresses. My father was trained as a tailor, and he did make suits once in a while for people. There weren't many people who wanted tailor-made suits in that town, but a few of them did. One of them was a doctor. And this doctor, who was our major physician in our town of Ocean City, New Jersey, actually was born in Alabama. He came from Birmingham. He went to the University of Alabama, went to medical school. And then during the 1930s Depression, he moved up from the Deep South, and he had a practice in Ocean City. And he was very prominent in due time. And my father was very proud to have him as a customer. And after the point when I couldn't get into college became a reality, my father once said to Dr. Aldrich J. Crow, shame I can't get my son into college, but he just doesn't seem to have the grades. And Dr. Crow answered, well, I could get him into Alabama. And my father was interested. I'm not sure my father knew where Alabama was, and I certainly never knew where Alabama was either. But the doctor had a connection down there. He knew the dean of admissions. That's a pretty good connection. So he made an inquiry, and somehow I got accepted as a freshman because of Dr. Crow, an alumnus. So I went down there, and I took journalism. There was not a school of journalism; it was just a department of journalism, and I wasn't even that good at that because, as I said before, journalism had a formula to it, and I wanted to be a storyteller, and so I wasn't necessarily conforming to the curriculum as espoused by the professors of journalism. But I did graduate from the University of Alabama, and in 1953, which is the year of my graduation from Alabama, I came to New York, and I had a friend I met on the Alabama campus. This friend was from Mississippi, and he said, my cousin, Turner Cowledge, is the editor of the New York Times now. And Turner Cowledge was from Mississippi, of course. And in 1952, a year prior to my graduation from Alabama, Mr. Turner Cowledge became the managing editor of the New York Times. And so his cousin, one of 600 cousins he probably had down there, because cousins come in great numbers when somebody in their family is prominent, then everybody becomes a cousin. But I went to New York at the behest of this fellow student who was distantly related to the managing editor of the New York Times. And I walked in, and I didn't have an appointment. But fortunately, just by being there and being well-dressed, as you can imagine, I'm a tailor's son, so I always was very carefully attired. And I walked in, and I got a chance to meet the managing editor. He didn't even know this cousin that I knew, and I didn't know that at the time. The lucky thing is I just showed up and made a good impression on the receptionist and got a chance to see the secretary of Turner Cowledge, who in turn got me to see Cowledge himself. And I got a job as a copy boy on the Times. This is in 53, summer of 53, after I graduated that spring. And I got in the doors of the New York Times, and while I wasn't assigned stories to write, I was, after all, just an intern, a clerk, an underling, a guy that got sandwiches and coffee for the managing editor and the assistant managing editor and some of the reporters and copy editors. just a flunky. But still, in my free time, I used to write little stories, and once or twice I got them published in the paper, not with my byline, not with my name on them, but they were printed on a little section that had like an op-ed section, and that was how I started.
Hmm.
But it's a way a lot of people start. You don't have to have all the. I just had a few lucky breaks. One was Dr. Crow getting me in Alabama, and the other thing was meeting that student in Alabama who was related. Or said he was.
Hmm.
He probably wasn't even Cowledge's cousin. Who knows? But I got my foot in the door.
I read this story, actually, that you started writing for the local paper when you were a kid in New Jersey, and it wasn't really because you had the ambition to be a writer, but because you were trying to get on the good side of your baseball coach.
Yeah, that's the way I started with high school reporting. You see, when you're in high school, the news really is sports. I mean, there's not much going on in a high school, except someone is elected class president and someone is the smartest kid and gets to make a speech at graduation. You know, that's true. But what's on in the paper every week, if you're in a small town as I am from, and you have a weekly newspaper, we didn't have a daily, it was a weekly newspaper in Ocean City, and it had high school news was mostly sports. The high school football team, the high school basketball team, the high school baseball team. But football was the big sport down there. And if you were in high school and if you wanted to write for the weekly newspaper, as I did, well, then you'd have to cover the sports. Well, I wanted to play the game a little bit, and I wanted to be a baseball player. And I did make the varsity in my senior year. I wasn't very good, but I was a second baseman. I was a weak hitting second baseman. And before that, I was on the junior varsity, and I thought one way to the coach said, "Hey, why don't you phone in some scores to the Atlantic City, the paper nearby, near Ocean City, about 10 miles away, is the Atlantic City Press. That was a daily paper, and someone has to call in the scores. And I thought, well, I'll do that because I'll ingratiate myself with the coach, and I'll be able to play. He'll give me more playing time. Maybe. Well, he didn't even give me more playing time, but it was that hope." That my doing a favor for the coach I'd benefit from in some way. Well, what I did benefit, I learned a little bit about journalism then, and I not only phoned in the scores, I then write a few paragraphs. Got the permission from the Atlantic City editor to write a few paragraphs, and I then wrote more, and then I became a regular contributor to the daily newspaper in Atlantic City, 10 miles away from Ocean City. So that's true. It's how I started.
Yeah. We have about 5 minutes here. I have a caller here I want to try to get in, so let's talk with them. They're in someone in Piatone on our toll-free line.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes. Hi. I read your Unto the Suns, and that was the most fantastic book I've ever read.
I'm very happy to hear you say that, because it's a very long book. Must have taken you a month.
Oh, but it was just beautifully, you know, from despair to... You covered it all.
Well, that's
wonderful. People that were just so happy, and then I remember the lady about the war. And
yeah,
it was a fantastic book.
But they're ordinary people, aren't they? In that book,
pardon me?
They're just ordinary people. I mean,
yes, right.
That's what I was saying at the beginning of the show, that you don't have to be writing about, you know, a president of the United States or General George S. Patton. You don't have to write about the well-known people. You can write about people that are not well known but have stories to tell, stories that we all can relate to.
Well, this was, I'm not Italian, but it was just.
Well, I'm so glad you said that.
Of the Italian experience, or of European, or, well, no, it's
Italian. It was very much my father and mother were both of Italian origin.
Yes.
And I wrote about that background and their historical connections to the past of Italy.
And I graduated in 1953 from the University of Illinois, which kind of I parallel your life.
That's for sure.
Your lifespan or time. Anyway.
So you're 78.
Yes. Well, I'm 79.
79.
But I'm close.
Well, that's good.
Okay.
Well, I hope you're well.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Thank you
so much.
I want to hear. We have a couple minutes left. I want to ask you about the project that you're working on now. I understand that you're writing a book about your marriage.
Yes, I've been married from 19, well, I was married in 1959, so it's 51
51 years. And you and your wife, Nan, who is a well-known figure in the publishing world, seems to me that you two are anything but ordinary people. And as much as I've read about this, I guess I'm moved to ask a question about it. And the question is, who are you writing this book for?
Well, I don't know who I'm writing anything for, except for the pleasure of telling a story.
Hmm.
And it's oversimplification to say, oh, I'm writing for myself. No, I'm not writing for myself. I'm writing for readers who like me might share some curiosity about a subject. And in my own particular case, I have curiosity about, how did this marriage last 51 years? How did it? What was it that held together? What was it that allowed it to survive the stress and strain of a long-term relationship, particularly when both people had different careers and yet did have children? We have two daughters who are now in their 40s. But it's a, you know, it's just a, it's an ordinary story, and then it's an extraordinary story.
Hmm.
Extraordinary in the way that it survived for more than a half a century. And during that more than a half a century, we come to know many people. And it's about a marriage, and it's about other people. Hemingway wrote a book once called A Movable Feast. It's about Paris in the 1920s and the many of the people he knew. Some of them fellow writers, and some of them bartenders and people in the streets of Paris. And it's a way, what I'm doing is, it's sort of like a movable feast. It takes place in New York, not Paris, but it is New York in the 1950s and 60s, when I was first a young married person here, was sort of like Paris. The 50s in New York, the 60s in New York, were like Paris in the 20s. It's a literary community. New York is a very artistic city, as you well know, with all the theater and publishing and dance and opera, everything is here. And we knew many of, my wife Nan and I knew many of the people who are performers of one kind or another. And so writing about New York and writing about our marriage and the ups and downs of our marriage and how it was altered when I took on certain writing projects and she also had her own career and writers that she worked with, and It's a story.
Mm.
It's like a novel, but it isn't. As I said before at the beginning of the show, I said it's reporting. It's reporting on intimacy. It's a chronicle of intimacy within a marriage.
And are you still using shirt cardboard to make notes on?
I've always done that. I mean, there are people on your show that get shirts back from the laundry and they throw the cardboard out, just trash to them. But it isn't. You take it, and I take those cardboards, and I cut them in 5 sections, and then I round out the top and the bottom, and they fit perfectly in my jacket pocket, and I write on them, and they become my notepad.
Uh-huh.
And I always do those.
Yeah, you're assuming there are people who listen to my show that actually send their shirts out. I'm not so sure.
Well, I'm not assuming anything, but if they probably know what I'm talking about.
I think, well, of a certain age, there are people who know what shirt cardboard is. There may be others who have no idea.
That's probably true. I'll explain it.
I did, though. I was really delighted as I was noodling around on the web to find a photo representation of the outline that you did for the Frank Sinatra piece.
Yes,
on a shirt board. It looks like an illuminated manuscript from the Middle Ages. I liked it very much.
I'm grateful. I feel sometimes as I'm a monk from the Middle Ages, in some monasteries, as a scrivener trying to keep the records straight from antiquity.
Well, I don't think that anybody should have to defend their disinclination to use things like word processors. Or I know you've talked about the fact that you feel that using a tape recorder is a real off-putting kind of thing to introduce into an interview.
Well, I mean, it means that people, when they talk to you, are going to be cautious because they know that whatever they say, even if it's something they don't entirely mean. A slip of the tongue, for example. They have no protection. It's there. And I'm so sensitive to sometimes people having trouble explaining themselves, and they reach for the word, and they mull over in their mind what it is they're trying to say. And it's just, we writers, for example, if we put a piece of paper in a, let's say we still use a typewriter, as I do, and you put a piece of paper and you start typing. Now, the first sentence you type, or the first part of a sentence, a phrase, is not at all what you want to have in print, because these first drafts, these first attempts at writing, communicating, is not what you want to have there in print, because when you finally get into print, you want it to be exactly what you think, exactly as you wish to say it. And now, when people are asked to talk into a tape recorder, if they're given a question, they have to answer it, they sometimes, either they're going to be so cautious, they're going to be so fearful of saying the wrong thing, that they'll tell you nothing, or they'll put it in such a way that means nothing. But if they can, if you don't have that recorder, you can go over again and again and again, and you can get them finally to say it in a way that they can live with it, that it, you're being fair with them, too. I think the tape recorder puts people in a risky position, because so often in political life or public life, people say something and they don't, it's not really what they mean, but they're quoted again and again. And if they're powerful people, if they're public people, if they're a politician, for example, the next day's headline misrepresents them. Though in a sense they said it. Yes, they did. Word for word, they did say it. But under the pressure of the moment, or their willingness and their foolishness, in a way, to reply to a question without having the opportunity to think about what they're saying, these are times when they come to regret it.
I'm so sorry to have to interrupt you, but we're going to have to stop
I'm at the end of the time with you, and it's been very pleasurable.
Well, here, it's been a great pleasure for me as well. Yeah. Our guest, Gay Talese, you can find his books in the bookstore, in the library, including this new collection of his sports writing, The Silent Season of a Hero, The Sports Writing of Gay Talese. Just a week ago, he was this year's recipient of the Illinois Prize for Lifetime Achievement in Journalism.